Hello and welcome to Conversations on the Avenue with me, Arslan Mohammed. In this edition, we're very excited to bring you an exclusive in-depth conversation with Dr. Cliff Lawson of London's Hayward Gallery on the new exhibition showing at Concrete at Altical Avenue this month, entitled Adapt Survive, Notes from the Future. Adapt to Survive presents work by seven international artists, each of whom theorise in various ways on possible manifestations of the future. Through a rich blend of film, sculpture and text-based work, the exhibition takes a sometimes playful, sometimes sobering journey through the radical ideas of change and hybrid forms of architecture, biology, technology and language that are shaping our futures. The exhibition features pieces by Anne Lisegaard, Julien Charrier, Reina Ganal, Margarita Humeau, Bedwear Williams, Andreas Angelikadakis, and Yumna Shala. And it was first exhibited at the Hayward Gallery in London at their Henny project space this spring. Now, an expanded version of that show marks the first time that a group show from the Henny project space has travelled internationally. And with its themes of futurism, innovation, radical creativity, and ingenious ideas, it fits perfectly into the Concrete exhibition space at the heart of Altical Avenue. So, without further ado, let's meet Dr. Cliff Lawson, who will walk us through the works on display with his insights, context, and reflection.
Hi, Cliff. It's very good to have you with me. Let's begin with the idea behind the London exhibition. So, you're the curator of Adapt to Survive. What's the fundamental idea of the exhibition, and why is this theme so relevant now?
Yeah, well, this exhibition, Adapt to Survive, Notes from the Future, was presented in the Henny Project space at the Hayward Gallery in London, opened in April of 2018. And I guess that's a bit of a funny question. Why is the future so relevant now? as we hurtle through time and space, the future is sort of always seems relevant in some respect, whether it's, you know, planning on where you're going to go on holiday, or how to get to work when you wake up. But I think in particular, I was detecting two general trends, and one is to do with society as a whole and the sort of future orientedness of society. To an extent, it seemed to be largely fueled by technology, as we sort of integrate more and more tech into our daily lives. But it also, and perhaps not unrelated, seemed to be the drive, the prerogatives of various societal organizations and institutions, from universities to private companies, but also governments, to look forward, not just in terms of planning, but in terms of trying to make some intelligent guesswork about where they want to be, or how they want to define themselves or be seen in the future. And so parallel to that general societal trend, artists are responding, are thinking along those same lines, looking at the future, but often in more critical and complex ways than are sometimes articulated by the other places that I mentioned.
So in essence, it could be that artists are looking at what could be the negative impacts of very, very strident tech policies undertaken by governments around the world, that sort of thing.
Well, I think artists in general love to ask questions. and that's a real strength of art, is you have the freedom, in a way, to explore, to be inquisitive, to ask questions, and to try and understand, if not reveal in a different way, something about the world around us. So if you're looking to the future, or to the present, to how things in the present are going to affect us in the future, you can ask some pretty weighty and hefty questions. You can pose interesting questions through art that you don't need to necessarily answer if you're not, you know, filling out a strategic report for the next financial year or something like that.
Absolutely. And so let's expand on this a little. What What would you say are the questions that have revealed themselves to be at the heart of this show?
Well, the exhibition Adapt to Survive brings together seven international artists, the work of those artists, with different questions, different views about the future. And they range quite a bit from architecture to language to societal structures, of course, to the environment. But what's interesting about this combination of artists is that within their artworks, they actually blend those different spheres and disciplines. And so you have, for example, in one film by Andreas Angelodakis, you have a building which actually acts like an organism. And this isn't, you know, it's not a prediction for the future, but it's an interesting concept of maybe an imaginary future. Where you have these hybrid forms moving into each other, sometimes enabled by technology, but sometimes not.
We have a version of the show coming to Dubai. Why were these particular works selected for the Dubai iteration of Adapt to Survive?
Well, I think the interesting thing about bringing the show to Dubai is that actually it's something of an expanded version. So the show is actually a little bit bigger, heading to Concrete at Al Sirkal Avenue, and that's simply by virtue of the gallery space is bigger in Dubai. So what we've been able to do with a couple of the works, we've maintained the same artists, so what you'll have is those same seven artists and their explorations of the future. But for a couple of them, we've swapped out for some other artworks, that some more substantial artworks. One of the artworks by Yumna Chlala, which is a response in a way to the specific place of installation. She'll do a site-specific version of her work for Concrete.
That's work which will be directly responding to Al Sirkal Avenue and the Concrete space.
In terms of installation, yes, the exhibition consists of a film, but also a configuration of abstract decals, if you will, that are applied to the building. So I'm working with her on how to present that specifically in the architecture of the gallery.
In the show, we have quite a variety of artists. So we start off with Anne Liesegaard, been featuring quite heavily on the Al Sirkal social media, because I think it's such an intriguing image, visual, of this fox with a sort of slightly zany voice. Now, Time Machine, which is her piece here, what's the story of Time Machine?
So, Anne Liesegaard's work, Time Machine, in title, actually quotes H.G. Wells' Time Machine. It's a sort of throwback to this piece of then fiction that H.G. Wells wrote in 1895. It's a pretty far callback. But this novel is actually considered one of the first works of science fiction, in which the idea of time travel is first brought forward, and that's pretty amazing thing to think about these days. So the first time that somebody actually thought you could cross time.
Is that really the first time in the arts and literature that the concept of time travel had appeared?
Well, I think within the context of science fiction, I think you could probably argue in some other perhaps religious texts that you might get a loose version of that. But in terms of genre and the way that I think we think of time travel now, where you've got a machine that sort of hurdles you through time and space, that's the first time that that's articulated. Well, I mean, Anne, in title, her piece quotes that work, but the piece itself takes the shape of a sculpture with a computer rendered a 3D projection inside of it, and that is of a fox, and it's this this fantastic creature that you describe as being visible in relation to the exhibition's poster and so forth. This fox speaks to you, and it's quite enthralling in the sense of you sort of stand in front of it, and you can actually have an animal talking to you for a while. But on the other hand, it's quite frightening because it's uncanny, but it's also a character that speaks to you in a very sort of garbled and fragmented way. And it seems as though this fox has traveled backwards in time to meet you from the future. And has some message and some text, but that's all been quite corrupted en route, maybe.
Oh, I see. And why did she choose a fox? Is it some sort of dystopian future where just the foxes survive or something like that?
Not entirely sure on the specific choice of animal for Anne. but certainly does the job of standing up on its front legs and giving a direct address.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing this one. Next up, Julien Charrier, and he has Metamorphism, that's it. And this is something which is pretty much focused on natural resources, and taking as an example, the minerals that we use in our iPhones and laptops and all the tech that surrounds us.
Yeah, Julien actually showed Metamorphism in London. So he's an artist in Dubai who we have slightly different work by. So he'll present actually a work that he first presented at the Venice Biennial, and it takes the shape of these large columns. It's an installation, it's a sculpture and an installation comprised of salt from extremely large salt flat in Bolivia. They sort of forecast a time in the future when we are mining for natural resources, largely for elements, for technology. A time where this, natural, beautiful, natural salt flat sort of has the foundations pulled out from under it, in the sense, in terms of there being a cavity where we've gone in for lithium, which we commonly use nowadays for batteries, to power everything, all these mobile devices. So Julien's work, hover on a very similar theme of our relationship to the planet and the sort of rabid consumption of natural resources.
They're quite bleak predictions of a future where we've exhausted all the natural resources that are available to us.
On the one hand, they can be read as that. I mean, I think on the other, they're quite mysterious and alluring. What Julien does is often present us with some particular object or representation of an object, which itself has a very intricate and decided sculptural form. So you go in there and there's something very intriguing about it. It's not repulsive to a start. It's intriguing and it invites exploration. And then you start to unpick these narratives and start to understand the kinds of questions that he's asking.
So it's almost aesthetically complete in itself as being an incredibly attractive, engaging item. And then once you start to engage with it, you start finding more and more depth and, like you said, narratives there.
I'd say it treads that line, balances that on that line.
Next up, we have Rainer Ganal's film, I Hate Karl Marx. Now, this is something where we are looking at the political, sort of geopolitics, really, isn't it? It's a world where China is the dominant political power. Countries have gone communist and everyone's speaking Chinese. So it's a sort of something which is predicting happening in the future if we take sort of, the political trends that we see today to really rather crazy extreme.
I guess it depends who you ask how crazy it is.
But I mean, it's sort of like taking a political infrastructure that we have now and then just sort of pushing it to just the limits of how that far could go.
Rainer's film presents us with a very interesting snapshot of imagined future time. And what I find fascinating about that is nowadays, when you talk to people about the political future, it tends to be a version of late capitalism. And Rainer provides us with a snapshot of what future under communism might look like. But he does so in a very tongue-in-cheek way. And the film is presented as an episode in which a German woman is yelling in a public street at a bust of Karl Marx, and it's a staged set. So she's angry and she's yelling at the statue for this short episode. And what you discover is that this world under communism isn't the communism that she thought it was going to be, a Marxist communism. It's Chinese communism, and so it has sort of that future has sort of fulfilled itself, but in a halfway, but not the fully expected way. And what's happened in that process is she has actually lost her heritage and history because it's not a German communism. And so within this sort of outburst of emotion, lots of irony, and it's quite amusing because it seems disproportionate, and obviously the statue is a bust, so it doesn't respond at all. It just stares off into space, but does ask some, really interesting questions about nationhood and about, in the future, in terms of boundaries and histories and national histories.
To me, on an initial reading, communism, I mean, China is the only superpower in the world which is a communist state. It seems rather anachronistic. It's a philosophy rooted very much in the past, and it was an interesting choice, I thought, for this film.
I think one of the interesting things as well, going along the way, is that, you know, in particular in the UK, you know, obviously every country has its own political history, and its own understanding of other countries' political histories. And in the UK here, you know, the Communist Party and this left the right political spectrum, it wasn't that long ago that it was, I guess you could say, think of as more balanced in terms of the majority of mindshare political views. So it's an interesting one to place in different countries and see how people respond to it. I think what's interesting about film is what a personal snapshot it is. So these are big geopolitical issues, but the film is entirely about this woman's individual response and her individual situation.
Next, we have Marguerite Humeau, and I really like the sound of this. This is the Sphinx-like structure, which is talking about state control, observation, surveillance, and so on.
Marguerite is a really interesting thinker and artist. She works with civilizations, if one can say that, with the idea of civilizations and the idea of sort of epochs and big mythical creatures. So her piece Harry II, which is in the exhibition, is a sculpture that combines different aspects. I mean, it's almost a collage of a sculpture. So it contains bits and pieces from raptor fencing, which is a sort of security fencing. So they're spiky bubbles, but cast in a sort of artificial human flesh. It's crowned on the top by a three-headed wing-like creature. It's almost some sort of falcon or eagle, but has three heads. And the piece is, in a way, abstract, but it sort of calls to the future, to a place where the concerns that we have with security, with surveillance, with the way that we understand ourselves in relation to higher beings, is actually a common way of thinking across civilizations. And she often goes back to the figure of the Sphinx being this mythical creature that's comprised of other creatures who, on the one hand, are predators, some of whom might kill or feast on humans, but combined all together into a mythical creature, a creature which is both predatory but also protector in some views. So she works with these sort of hybrid forms to look at what are essentially sort of societal structures on belief, and articulates those in a sculptural form.
Belief in the power of these mythical creatures, you mean?
Well, in an early case, it would be belief in the power of a mythical creature. You might articulate that in the present by a sort of belief in technology, and somehow maybe in the future those two become intertwined again. It's certainly a belief in our place in the universe, in terms of how we relate to superior beings or an inferior being.
And you mentioned earlier this is something which is common to civilizations and societies' relationship with these icons and strength.
Well, I think you do find that, and if you look at different mythologies, different religions, the idea of how power is manifest can be both terrifying but also tremendously powerful and embracing, and it's always this sort of double-edgedness.
You have to include a lot of things in there. You have to include a sense of overwhelming power and an edge of menace, in that there's an ability to enforce that power, and then also a sort of reassuring sense of, by submitting to this, an ideology, that you are safe and secure.
Yeah, and I think what fascinates her is that common structure of belief, and how that is actually common to lots of societies, but also lots of different civilizations.
So we now move to Wales and Bedwyr Williams with Tir y Môr. And what the note I have here is that it's an imaginary megacity in rural North Wales.
That's the note, yes. And that is what you get in the film. Yeah, it's a film. It's a 20 minute long film. Depicts in very highly rendered computer detail this fictional megacity in rural North Wales. Through the course of 20 minutes, you actually will see the city go through a full day and night cycle, so 24 hours. And Bedwyr has worked with a computer graphics company on the CG aspects of this. so that all the lighting reflections and environment simulation are all accurate.
What was it about this particular work that really caught your interest and made you want to include it in the show?
Well, I think it's entirely engrossing, actually. You sort of sit there, and the striking thing is that you see this megacity, and it's completely unpopulated. That's uncanny. But for the lack of people, you then have the voice of this narrator who takes you through some of the snippets of people who occupy the city. And you learn things about city planning, about the intent when they were putting this thing together. You learn about other people who, you know, carry on their business, go to the shops, they go to work. All these things are familiar. Well, anybody who lives in a city, but even not, because it's daily living. But it all sits on this rather uncanny, perhaps uncomfortable moment of what's at present a very beautiful, pristine, natural area, but with, imagined with giant skyscrapers plonked down in and around the lake.
So it sounds like almost like a very futuristic Undermilk Wood, almost.
Well, I think cities are expanding and the world is becoming more and more dense, and it's not an uncommon story. And it's something that we all have to think about whether actually we live in those particular cities or not.
So the next work is Andreas Angelidakis, and this is The Walking Building. And you mentioned this earlier. This is a sort of themed about a museum, but it's not really, well, I think it is looking at the role of a museum within a society, but it's a bizarre sort of mobile museum that crawls along the streets. Have I got that right?
Andreas's film does depict a museum which crawls down the streets, as you say. It actually starts, with a historical vision from the 1960s about a building that sort of might move and respond and change to its environment. And what Andreas has done here is posed a bit of a question about the museum of the future and how that might need to respond to the needs of artists in the future. And so taking this idea of the mobile museum or the building as a kind of organism, and it's moving as a sort of computer rendered object through the cityscape, one presumes, landing wherever it needs to in order to engage some people or wherever, maybe wherever it finds room.
It's a really interesting idea, because you mentioned just now it imagines how a museum could respond to the needs of artists in the future.
Yeah.
And I guess what part of the mobile aspect of this piece is a response to what artists might need? How might artists need a mobile museum in his world, do you think?
I think one of the things that Andreas looks at is what we already see as networked cultures, and in a way the non-staticness of ourselves, even of art, of objects. So if one sort of follows that to some sort of logical conclusion and thinks about everything being constantly in flux and in this dynamic movement, then it might generate such an absurdity as a mobile museum. But Andreas also, this is posited like a kind of fantasy of the future as well. So you give in these fragments or tips of how it might engage or respond to artists. But, unlike a urban city planner, it's not a detailed manifest for how this would actually work.
It's definitely much more the metaphor and the ideas that he conjures up with this very, very mm-hmm. intriguing piece. And coming to the United Arab Emirates, I'm really interested in this idea of the role of the museum in general. If you go to the old museums in, say, here in Berlin or in London, and you see them as repositories of artifacts and treasures, you go to the Middle East, and the role of the museum, certainly in places like Abu Dhabi, on Saadet Island, or on Qatar, seems to be a sort of much more glossy affair, and it seems to be a much more responsive to ideas of a modern city, to this an ideal of 21st century urban environment is the museums there. But I wondered if you had any thoughts on that. Quite intrigued by this, by the different roles and functions of museums in the West and in the Middle East.
Well, I think, as you say, museums are these fantastic repositories of culture and sort of for cultures and societies. It's obviously quite tough to make a broad statement across our world museums, but it is interesting how different museums are constructed to present things or ideas. And in the sort of mid to late 20th century, there's an increasing tendency towards the sort of the scale of museums, most often represented through spectacular architecture. So those two things quickly get bound up with each other. And I do find it interesting how different cultures will represent both their own histories, but also how they articulate those histories in relation to other world histories and to other countries and societies. The amount of bridging or not that's perceived to be required in order to participate in a kind of international dialogue.
The next work is by Yumna Chala, and this is The Butterfly Already Exists in the Caterpillar. This is also touching on a museum theme because it's part of Yumna's ongoing project, The Museum of Future Memories.
Yes, yeah, and a brilliantly poetic title. Yeah, the butterfly is sort of already in the caterpillar, sort of signifying in a way her talent as a writer.
It is very poetic, and you did mention this work is being sort of perhaps reconfigured to work specifically within concrete.
Yes, yeah. And so her sort of ongoing project, Museum of Future Memories, yes, it is also museological, but it has to do, I think, with how we... with what the trying to find out or discover what's at the heart of museums. And we earlier spoke of museums as these vast repositories of objects. And I think what's interesting about Yumna's work is she sort of cuts into that and understands that the objects themselves signify memories. And so what you have is, of course, these great things, but behind the things are their significances. I think Yumna plays with this idea and looks to the future, where what you have are what you have is a repository of fragments of memories. So there's no vases on display. There are sort of snippets of people's lives, and in particular, she looks at this area sort of in a fictional future in Norway, and how after a Silicon Valley type city has come and then gone, people, the residents of that city sort of deal with themselves and the idea of place and their role within a place.
It's a narrative about not only the creation of a huge metropolis, but then its disappearance, the aftermath of its existence.
Yeah, through an extremely poetic way. Yeah, so what's interesting about Yumna's work is in some other artworks, you have the idea of a place being built, but Yumna's question is then what happens after that. So there's a kind of the future has come and gone and you're in another future, so there's a nice sort of set of things that fold in upon each other, as you kind of get the hint of in terms of the butterfly and it's the potential of that within a kind of chrysalis or caterpillar.
Certainly looking over these artists that we've just been talking about, I'm really struck by the scale of their ideas, the scale of their vision. We're not, we're talking about civilizations, we're talking about very big themes, we're talking about Chinese communism. All these themes are very big ideas, and they're very bold ideas as well. And I think that's another thing that runs through the pieces that we've just been talking about. I was wondering, is there anything that strikes you particularly about Dubai that makes it feel like this is the right place to take this show?
I think in terms of the exhibition and taking it to Dubai and presenting it at Concrete, a lot of it makes sense in a way. Dubai is a city that has arranged itself and some of its infrastructure and strategy to be forward-facing, and that runs in a way from an individual level up to a governmental level. This is so interesting that there'll be the Museum of the Future opening soon, going back to museums again, and it's tremendously interesting to me as how, in terms of museum culture and gallery culture, the idea of showing and how you think about showing the future. Also, how much updating that will need.
The Museum of the Future is something in perpetual need of updates, I think.
From the outside, the city definitely does appear forward-facing in the sense of, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, lots of the big ideas in terms of big infrastructure, big buildings, big hotels, we can terraform the earth even, have come to fruition in many ways. And sure, I suppose lots of other things have dropped by the wayside, but there does definitely seem to be this ethos that perhaps still permeates in different ways in terms of imagining the possibilities and then realizing them. Sort of at speed. So, you know, any other city in Europe would have taken 50 years to do that, but it's done in five in Dubai.
When they decide to do something, it really is done very, very quickly indeed. There's definitely an energy there. And that's why I think that, yeah, this is a very interesting group show to be bringing out there. And it's great that this is the first travelling show from the Haywards Project space to be going anywhere. And yeah, I think it's a wonderful juxtaposition.
I think it's something which both acknowledges and probes. The show, I think, makes sense. Absolutely, traveling to concrete and some, you know, I think a lot of people will sort of recognize it. Absolutely, will feel a bit native in a way, but I think that as an exhibition of artwork and with these artists engaging all these fantastically broad questions from a variety of broad angles and through different media, there's a richness there that allows you to explore and to get underneath some of these huge topics.
Well, it definitely looks like being one of the exhibitions of the year, for sure, at the Al-Sakal Avenue Concrete Space. In the meantime, thank you very much for talking to me today, and I look forward to seeing you in Dubai.
Great. And you? Cheers. Thanks very much.
And that was Dr. Cliff Lawson talking to me about Adapt to Survive, which is on at Concrete at Al-Sakal Avenue until November the 21st. For more details and information on the programme of related events, do check out www.concrete.ae. So, until next time, thanks for listening and following our podcast. And of course, do share and spread the word if you can. It really does all help. And you can also follow us on social media, of course, and share your thoughts about the show and the ideas in it with us there. But in the meantime, from me, it's goodbye and enjoy the show. Conversations on the Avenue is written and presented by Arslan Mohammed on behalf of Al-Sakal Avenue. Big thanks to the team at Al-Sakal Avenue and, of course, to Dr. Cliff Lawson for their help and support in putting this episode together.